This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets. Just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeff Cullen. Jeff has been heavily involved in providing medical support in rugby for many years, both at a club and international level. He recently contributed to an article on concussion management on the British Journal of Sports Medicine blog. Previously, I've been privileged to work alongside Jeff in the Scotland under 16 and under 17 age grade programs. So welcome to the podcast, Jeff. It's great to have you on today.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Rob. Thank you.
So for those who haven't come across you on the various Scotland camps and bits and bobs that you do, give us a bit of a background. What did your kind of childhood look like from a sport perspective? What did you get involved in, and how did that transition into what you're doing today?
I was brought up mainly in initially Glasgow, then up in Inverness, went to school in Inverness. It was mainly football, I think, up there. There was a bit of rugby in Inverness at that point, but I think it's probably developed since then, certainly. You know, obviously Highlands, quite a Highland RFC now, quite a big club, etc. So I think it's probably developed over the years. I mean, it's many more years than I care to remember, that's for sure. So, I was quite involved in sort of skiing as well. Enjoy skiing and winter sports as well. But I think probably the reason I got into rugby was when I started my GP job. My main job's at a GP, and I moved to the board, Scottish Borders, in 1995. And obviously, you know, this is rugby country down here. So I remember when I started the job, the senior partner at that time was actually the doctor for the club, but he'd problems with sort of increasing disability. So basically the first week I was in the job, he kind of took me around to the rugby club and said, right, Jeff, you'll be taking over next week. So that was my introduction basically to it. So, and I've, you know, been with Selkirk for, well, 25 years plus now. And involved at the SRU for over 10 years, I think. And as you know, like we worked together. I'm currently one of the under 16 national team doctors and under 17 national team doctors. I'm involved in other sports as well. You know, I'm involved with SFA, covering some of their national squads, mainly age grade squads. And I also work at British Gymnastics. Also covered the European Athletics when they were in Glasgow a couple of years ago. Andrew Murray was the medical officer for that and invited a few of us along to help out with that.
Mm. So it's fair to say you kind of have blended into a bit of the sports medicine side of things, as well as obviously your day-to-day general practice.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say sports medicine is my main interest, I think. But it's, you know, you can combine that with general practice. I think general practice gives you quite a good background for working in sport. Because a lot of the stuff you deal with, it's not just sports medicine, but there's also a lot of it's a primary care type related stuff as well when you're away in camp, etc. You know, and also, you know, I'm part of the kind of rotation for sort of the background medical staff at Murrayfield for international. So, all been well if the Six Nations goes ahead. I'm supposed to be working at the Italy game in March. We'll have to see how things pan out, obviously.
So what is it about the differences between sports medicine and general practice? What is it that kind of gets you going for the sports stuff? Is it just the thrill of match day, or is it the camaraderie, or
I think it's a combination of things. You know, I do love being pitch side, and I've really missed it in the last year with the pandemic. I've not really been pitch side because I don't cover an elite team all the time. I've really missed it, I must admit. So I enjoy that. I enjoy the camaraderie, you know, being in camp. I enjoy traveling with a team. I enjoy even just the organization and the you know, the sort of expertise that's required in it. So I'm quite passionate about it, and I really enjoy doing it. And my plan is, I mean, I'm, you know, a certain age, certain, you know, sort of 50 odds. My plan is, even if I retire from general practice, I still want to carry on doing sport medicine for a number of years, as long as I can, certainly. Mm.
So one of the big areas that you obviously have kind of, I guess, developed maybe a significant interest in, or have been heavily involved in, is the area of concussion. And I know you've done a lot of training for the SIU, but also, you know, more widely than that, been involved in discussions that surround the topic of concussion. And it's something that there's still a fair bit of confusion around, I think, when you talk to the average parent or the average coach on the ground, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the important thing to say is that education is the key around concussion, and trying to get the message out to as many people that are involved in sport as possible. That's not just medical staff, it's, you know, it's referees, coaches, parents, etc. And I'm still, even these days, you know, I'm still surprised sometimes with maybe the lack of understanding or knowledge about it. You know, I still come across that. And I know that there's, you know, we'll talk about this in more detail, but, you know, the great thing in Scotland is, of course, is that the Sport Scotland Concussion Guidelines, which were introduced in 2015, they were updated in 2018. But there, that was the first time anywhere in the world that there were concussion guidelines for all sports in one country. So that covers all sports in Scotland, but other countries have adapted that as well. And obviously we can discuss the details about some of those guidelines as well. Mm. But it's, you know, even if people know one thing, it's to know the Sport Scotland Concussion Guidelines. If in doubt, sit them out is the title of the document. Mm.
So let's start with the real bare basics then. What is a concussion?
Well, concussion is basically a traumatic brain injury, and it causes a functional disturbance of the brain function. And I think that's important, you know, that to get that across. This is actually, a brain injury. You only get one brain at the end of the day, and therefore you've got to look after it. And I think, you know, I know that some of us that have been working in sport for a number of years remember many years ago that it was maybe not really taken seriously enough. It was a bit of a joke, you know, it was a badge of honour, etc., you know, but thankfully over the years, I've seen this develop over the years, and I must admit there's a lot of controversy currently this now in the media, etc., but I think there's a lot of more awareness of it, and the fact that this is a serious injury, and you've got to take it seriously and manage it properly, basically, you know. Mm. So, you know, we can talk maybe later about some of the issues that are currently in the media, obviously. But it's an important topic, and I think that's why I'm kind of passionate about it. And it's everyone that's involved in sport needs to be aware of the guidelines and needs to know how do you manage it, how do you spot it, etc.
I think particularly at the youth level, it's important, is it? Because you're at that age where you're invincible and you're not thinking about what am I going to do when I'm 40 years old and I'm not playing sport anymore. Or, yes, you know, there's life beyond sport. Yes. And actually your brain's a big part of that.
Absolutely. And you know, we've been, you know, working together when you've maybe had to remove a young, you know, an adolescent or a youth player from play in a critical game, and they're really upset about it. But, you know, you've got a duty of care to these athletes, you know, and it's important that, you know, it's one game or it's a few weeks out of their life, and they may have a long sport career ahead of them. So it's important that you get these decisions right, you know. Mm.
So for those, you know, who, again, maybe aren't initiating concussion, what are the kind of typical ways that you see? Obviously, being pitch side, you've seen a fair few of them. What are kind of the most common ways, most common injury kind of, I guess, situations that concussions happen in?
Well, you know, concussion, as I say, it's traumatic brain injury. It's usually caused by a, you know, either direct blow to the head or to the rest of the body or to the neck, where the head and the neck move quickly, sort of whiplash type injury. And basically, you know, it's any injury where the head moves inside, the brain moves inside the skull, it's in an enclosed space. So that's what causes the actual concussion. So, you know, if we look at rugby, for example, of course, most of these occur in the tackle, you know. And obviously, you know, World Rugby are looking a lot at the laws of rugby to try and reduce the chances of sort of head impacts, etc. So if you're talking about sort of recognizing concussion pitch side, it applies not just to the medics watching the game. It's a fast moving game, rugby, for example. So therefore there's a lot going on and you have to really be watching everything that's happening. But it's important that maybe coaches, referees are also aware of the game and what's happening and can alert you to something happening. So you're looking at you know, head impacts, or you know, it can be, you know, a knee on the head, or it can be during the tackle, or it can be falling from a line out, or anything where there's contact, basically, you know. And obviously it's not just rugby. I mean, you know, there's other sports where concussions pretty common, you know, you know, ice hockey, American football, you name it, you know, so, you know, football, etc. So any game where there's, or any sport where there's likely to be contact. If you want specifics about symptoms, what we call symptoms and signs of concussion, I mean, there are what we call the signs, which is the things that you can see, but and some of them may be obvious, some may not, and some of the symptoms may be subtle, and some of them may not be subtle. And the thing with concussion is it can take minutes, it can take a few hours, it can even take a couple of days or more for some symptoms to develop after a concussion. So if I'm pitch side, the kind of things, of course, you're looking for are obviously things like loss of consciousness, but there is sometimes a myth that, you know, you need to be knocked out to have a concussion, but that's not the case. You know, you only lose consciousness maybe in about 10% of cases of concussion. In the other 90%, there's no loss of consciousness. But other things we see are, you know, unsteadiness, what we call ataxia, sort of medical terms. So, you know, a player gets up and they're unsteady on their feet, you know, the kind of Bambi legs, if you like. And, you know, you'll have seen that often in games. And maybe sometimes even just they're slow to get up, possibly lying on the floor for, you know, lying on the pitch longer than you'd expect. Looking dazed, kind of, you know, blank kind of look, that sort of thing. And obviously more serious things like seizures, etc. as well. But apart from the things you can see or things happening on the pitch, there's also a number of symptoms that they may have. So, you know, for example, headache, nausea, double vision, you know, vomiting, etc. Looking kind of dazed or you know, confusion, you know, not really knowing where they are, etc. There's a number of symptoms. I mean, if you want to look at this in more detail, as I say, the concussion guidelines are good to have a look at. I'll just show you, that's the document there, you know. So, you know, for anyone listening to the podcast, if you go into Sport Scotland concussion guidelines, and the most recent one's 2018, it was updated in 2018. Original one came out in 2015. So that's the kind of things we look for. I think it's pretty fair to say that the more you work in sport, probably the better you get at kind of detecting it. I think, you know, experience counts for quite a lot, but I do rely also on, like, the referee. I rely on you guys, you know, SNC, people doing the video analysis, coaching staff, etc. And, you know, as you know, in the under 16s program, we've often had a concussion talk to the players, which also involves the coaches, SNC, etc., and physios as well, so that everyone's kind of on the same page with it, basically. You know,
I think that's an important one, isn't it? That it's not, you know, if a parent or other coach spots a concussion, it's not a case of, oh, well, I'll let the other person wait to see it. It's actually anyone can raise it. And we've been in a situation where a parent in the crowd actually raised it because the player had moved on, and obviously everyone's looking at the opposite end of the field, and actually a parent's looking at their child and saying, I don't think he's right.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've had games, remember, you know, you'll remember the game we were down in Wales, and there was so much going on in the game that you can't possibly spot everything, because you're maybe dealing with one player that's injured and there's actually something else happening in the game. So you're really relying on your working as a multidisciplinary team to spot potential cases of concussion and you know, make sure that players are removed from play. That's the important thing, I think, is the key to this is that, you know, if there's any potential concussion, that a player is removed from play immediately and assessed. There are certain what we call red flags, you know, that might be more serious, that might require, you know, immediate transport to a local hospital. So things like severe neck pain. If someone was potentially concussed with severe neck pain, you wouldn't want to remove them from the pitch without medical personnel there knowing how to safely do that. But things like increasing drowsiness, repeated vomiting, anything like that, there are certain things that would suggest that they should be transported immediately to hospital for further assessment. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, I've got, you know, a couple of anecdotal stories of how it can present, you know, like I remember there was one game I was covering, I think it probably at Selkirk, and there was a player who hadn't been real, you know, there was no obvious sign that he'd had a concussion, but someone came in and spoke to me and said, "Jeff, he's getting the line out calls all wrong." And I actually went over and I thought, yeah, he's been concussed, and we removed him. So it's stuff like that. Now that was in the last few years, you know, and I think that's a greater awareness by other players to look after their teammates, you know, and I think the culture has changed. You know, I think now I get other players coming to me and say, look, he's not right, you know, he needs removed, you know, and invariably they're correct, you know. And, you know, and I had another case where there was a player who had seemed fine, like had you would say he was probably symptom-free following his concussion, but actually his flatmate who he stayed with said, you know, he's still not right, he's not himself, he's just emotionally a bit different and things. And sometimes that's what I mean, sometimes it can be quite subtle, you know.
So what does that immediate management look like? Like obviously we've said, you know, if someone is you know, has lost consciousness, you may not, you know, it may not be right to move them if someone's got severe neck pain. But if someone was, say, for you know, example, there's situations where, like you said, more unsteady on their feet or dazed and confused or getting slow to remove, what, from a coaching or parental perspective, what would be the suggestions for immediate management?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends. The scenario probably depends if you've got medical personnel there. So for example, you know, for ourselves in a national setup, it's probably different because there's doctors there, physios there that can assess them, etc. But the key to this is that it's if in doubt, sit them out as per the guidelines. You remove them from play, they don't go back to play same day, and they don't go back to play until symptoms have cleared and they've gone through the graduated return to play protocol, which we can discuss. They shouldn't be left alone. I know that's, you know, important. That certainly within the first 24 hours, if it's a child, they need a responsible adult to be looking after them. For adults, they shouldn't drive a car and they shouldn't consume alcohol immediately. You know, certainly within the first 24 hours and actually until their symptoms have settled. So it's important that players don't just wander off without seeing medical attention and get in a car and drive home. I mean, that's what we don't want, you know. So, and I think if there's no medical staff there, if, you know, there's a coach, you know, if you're looking after a team and someone's obviously concussed, I think you need to seek medical help, whether it's GP or A&E or whatever, if you don't have medical staff there that can assess them. They need assessed medically, certainly. And as I say, there's certain red flags. If they were complaining of neck pain, you wouldn't want to move them. You'd want medical help. You'd be calling an ambulance or whatever, obviously, to move them safely.
So that moves nicely onto that ongoing management. So say someone has been, you know, diagnosed by a medical professional with a concussion, and, you know, they've been, you know, gone through that 24 hours of rest. There's slightly different pathways, isn't there, based on, you know, suggestions for age. So those, you know, developing athletes are a bit younger versus a senior level athlete. And this is where a bit of the confusion arises in my experience, in that,
yeah, you know,
people don't necessarily understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the guidelines are slightly different. The updated ones from 2018 are slightly different in that it's actually all about rehabilitating the person rehabilitating the brain and getting them back to normal activities like school or work or whatever before you even think about return to sport. So you've got different phases. Phase one is what we'd call the relative rest period. And that's probably 24 to 48 hours. But it can be longer, you know, it depends on symptoms. One thing to say is, you know, that we're talking a bit about adolescent athletes and children, and what we do know is that they are for sure more susceptible to concussion. They take longer to recover, and there's a greater chance they might have a more serious outcome from concussion. Now, I don't want to be totally negative about all of this, because on the other hand, you know, sport and participation is great for kids and adolescents, and there's huge benefits from it, and particularly team sport in particular is great for lots of things, not just from physical health. So although there's concerns about concussion, I wouldn't want to see that putting, you know, children off playing sport at the end of the day. But if you go through the phases, we get phase one, where it's like relative rest, 24, 48 hours. Now, that actually also, there's important things to point out to them. So say you've got a 15-year-old lad who's been concussed, it's important they stay off their screens. Now, that might be a tall order telling a 15-year-old not to look at their phone or look at an Xbox, but we know that staring at a screen just, it prolongs the symptoms. So what I tend to tell them is, look, you know, if you do, if you know, you've got to stay off your screens for that first couple of days, because if you end up getting longer symptoms, it's going to be longer before you get back to playing rugby or sport or whatever. So that's usually the line I take with them. So the first day, you're really resting up as much as you can. After that, you want to start what we call phase two, where it's called return to normal life. So what you want to start doing is just start to do some activities and maybe small blocks, 10, 15 minutes at a time, maybe reading, you know, looking at the TV, maybe a slight activity. At this point during the rest period, you're not going back to training or physical activity in any way. So that's important, basically. Now, in the return to normal life, there are stages 1 to 4. And again, if you look at the guidelines, so basically what you're doing is just gradually increasing what you're doing in the various stages and what your activity, etc. Now, at any point during this, you want to make sure if there's any symptoms, then you go back and you reduce what you're doing slightly. Give me 2 seconds, I'm going to just shut the door. Hang on. So any symptoms at all, and you need to just take a step back again, basically. Now, after that, you know, as long as there are no symptoms, then you can look at your graduated return to sport, Now, the time scales for this are, for adults, it's basically 7 days of the rest period, but for under the age of 19, you're looking at 14 days. It's double, basically.
And that's a minimum, am I right?
That's, yeah, absolutely. So that's a minimum. So for example, if someone still had symptoms for 3 days, you got to tag that on, all right? So say an adult, it's 7 days, but if they still had symptoms for 3 days, you're really talking 10 days of that period of rest before you even get back to the graduated return to sport. And I think that sometimes that's not understood. You know, I think, you know, I remember before the guidelines came out, there was a kind of blanket rule of 3 weeks, you know, but it didn't take into account individuals and symptoms, etc. So, you know, people thought there was some just a kind of green light to get back to sport after 3 weeks, when in fact, you know, many returned to sport quicker than they should have, you know. So it's important to say it's not, these time scales aren't absolutely, you know, written in stone. It's dependent on symptoms.
And you, I just guess, go, that accounts for the severity, doesn't it? If someone has a really severe, concussion and is still experiencing those symptoms, then that delays them entering, you know, the next stage, doesn't it? Whereas someone has a slightly less severe concussion and they're not experiencing those symptoms, and they may progress a little bit quicker. But it's down to the individual and how they present, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And sometimes there doesn't appear to be any logic to it, because you can have two players who have what appears to be a similar impact in a game, and one can end up with a concussion and one doesn't. So there's a lot of factors at play here. But what we do know is that children and adolescents take a lot longer to recover, and you've just got to be extra careful with them. And, you know, certainly under the age of 13, you know, I would always, you know, you'd even be even longer for some of these children to get back to sport eventually. But as I said at the beginning, it's all about sort of rehabilitating the brain and rehabilitating the person. So the guidelines have changed a little bit. So after your rest period, you then do a graduated return to sport where you, and there's six stages to that, where the eventual stage is a proper return to play, but you're looking at light exercise, sport-specific exercise, then non-contact training, and then some full contact practice. In between those stages, in adults, it's probably a minimum of 24 hours. For under the age of 19, you're talking at least 48 hours, maybe up to 72 hours between these stages. So if you look at all of this together, the minimum that an adult can get back to play is 12 days, but in the under 19s, it's 23 days. But that's a minimum, you know. And actually, for a lot of players, it will be a lot longer than that. And you've just got to monitor them throughout the whole process. So if they go, say they go from light training to increased sport-specific training, and they start getting headaches or something like that, you have to put them back to the stage below, then you start again, you know. And it does take a while sometimes. I mean, but on a positive note, you know, the vast majority of adults will recover from their concussion within about 14 days, under the age of 19, usually within about 4 weeks. So, you know, I want to be positive about that. The vast majority of players recover well from the concussion, but it's about recognizing it and managing it appropriately, you know.
And that's where that, I think, the problems arise, isn't it? Is the second you say 23 days, kids get to 23 days, like, right, I'm allowed to play now. It's like, yes. No, that's not how it works. You kind of have to go through these different gateways
it's
to
not
make sure
how
you're
works.
Safe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you don't want to stick to rigid timescales when it comes to this. You know, and I always say to players that, you know, we just have to see how you go, you know. And it's not unusual for adolescent athletes to have symptoms that prolong for quite a few days at the beginning, and you're adding that on to the whole timescale. So, I mean, the other thing to say is, of course, if recurrent concussions, that's another... It complicates things even more, and we get more anxious about that. You know, like, so if a player's had more than one concussion in a 12-month period, then our timescales are much longer than that, and that's when you need expert advice from medical staff who deal with concussion. You know, and sometimes I've taken advice from senior doctors. You know, Dr. James Robson and you know, and people like that at the SRU. Just you know. To discuss it with them, how they think the time scales should go. So we've got to be very careful if players have had more than one concussion, you know, in a certain time scale.
Mm. So do you think, are we, you know, given it's becoming a more popular topic in the media, because I guess, as you say, there's been a bit of a lag in that practice has slowly been improving over the last, you know, few decades. And we're obviously seeing some of the problems now that players 30 years ago, you know, not being given proper care or not having these guidelines in place. Do you think we're seeing a genuine rise in concussions, or are we just having better diagnosis of concussions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I suspect a lot of it is we're diagnosing it more accurately, I suspect. Because the medical care, you know, in sport has increased dramatically, you know, hugely over the last 20, 30 years. But it's difficult to know, but I suspect we're probably diagnosing it more. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the media this now, you know, there's litigation going on, former football and rugby players that have played maybe 10, 20 years ago. But you know, there are a lot of positive things happening, you know, World Rugby always, you know, look at the laws of the game to try and cut down the risk of head contact. You know, in the elite level, of course, we've had the HIA process, where players are removed for an HIA assessment. But you know, that's only elite level, and it's important to know that at amateur and club level and school level, there is no HIA. It's recognised and removed and removal from play if concussion is suspected. But you've also seen, of course, you know, in football, you know, stopping heading the ball in children. You know, there's talk about the SFA and the FA introducing the concussion substitutes. You know, that I think some sports could learn a bit from rugby in the things like the HIA process at elite level and things like that. You know, I mean, there's been quite a lot of high profile cases in the media, you know, particularly football and recently. But I think, you know, certainly things are going in the right direction. But obviously there's concerns about emerging evidence of young players with conditions like dementia. And there's this condition called CTE, which is a pathological diagnosis. But there is a lot of emerging evidence about the relationship with recurrent head injury and these kind of what we call neurodegenerative conditions. So there's a lot of concerns about it, but there is also on the opposite side of the argument, there's a lot of positive things happening, you know, to, as I say, you know, went back to the original, you know, chat at the beginning that you know, that 30 years ago, it wasn't treated as seriously as it should have been, you know. But there's still a lot of scope for education. You know, I run a sports first aid course with a chap who's our local resuscitation officer, and we mainly get along youth football coaches, you know, who need to do the first aid certificate for working in, and I'm still somewhat surprised that the level of knowledge is not what I'd expect. You know, I mentioned the Sport Scotland concussion guidelines, and you know, at these courses, sometimes 60-70% haven't seen the guidelines. So there's more we can do. That's why I feel quite passionate about it, that from an education point of view, that, you know, we need to get the message out more, I think, to grassroots sport, you know.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I think you did, kind of covered it in your blog post for the British Journal of Sports Medicine, but it was quite a high profile incident at the last World Cup, wasn't there, with the Uruguayan player?
There was, yes.
Where he was quite clearly knocked out and then returned to play.
And you know, I mean, you know, even doctors that work in sport all the time and, you know, spent 20 years in sport, you can still miss concussions. I mean, you know, no one's infallible, you know, at the end of the day. But I think it's all about education, you know. I mean, we're lucky at elite level, you know, like an international, we've got a doctor who reviews video footage all the time. So there's a lot of people there who can spot these things. But when you're talking about games going on at club level and at schools, you know, we don't have all the benefits of that. And that's why you're relying on, you know, parents, teachers, coaches, whatever, referees, being aware of it, certainly. And, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's if in doubt, sit them out. So you're going to make sure that players are removed from play and not allowed to play on, you know, if there's any potential cases, you know.
So one of the things that, you know, a kind of rule of thumb we go by in strength and conditioning and physiotherapy is, you know, the best predictor of future injury is previous injury. Is that true of concussion in that, you know, as you gain the number of concussions, the susceptibility to future concussion increases?
Yeah, I think it is a risk of, you know, you have one concussion, there is a greater risk of another concussion. And it's not just concussions. I think there's been some evidence that concussion itself can then predispose you to other injuries as well, you know. So there's been a lot of papers recently looking at information like that, you know. It's certainly true of that, you know, in comparison to other, you know, to other injuries, certainly, you know. A couple of things that people often ask me as well, just to mention, is, you know, mouth guards and scrum caps. You know, there's sometimes a bit of a myth about them, and it's probably worthwhile just saying that the mouth guard is, you know, absolutely essential for protecting your teeth, but there's no evidence that it does anything to prevent concussions. And similar to scrum caps, no evidence that they'll prevent concussions. They'll stop you getting a cut in your head or your ears, but at this point, still no evidence that either of them are effective in prevention of concussions.
That's a really important
one. There's that's sometimes some parents, you know, they think they wear a scrum cap. Well, that's fine, you know, but it's important that they know that, certainly.
It comes back to those visible and invisible things, doesn't it? Like, okay, it's prevented maybe the visible thing on your skull in terms of maybe getting a scratch or, you know, getting an egg on the head, but it hasn't prevented your brain moving inside your skull.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember reading an interesting journal article where it talked about it, basically the kind of feeling of confidence that came with having a helmet and it being a false sense of confidence because
absolutely
were more likely to take risks.
And I think there was some evidence in some papers that actually, you know, wearing a scrum cap actually gave some players a false sense of security and may actually increase the risk of concussion because they feel invincible when they go in for a tackle, you know. So that's true, certainly. Yeah.
So if helmets don't work and you know gum shields don't work, is there anything we can do to prevent the concussion or reduce the likelihood?
I think it's you know it's. There's a lot of factors there. I mean, I think sort of certainly from an S&C perspective, like, I think making sure that players are as you know, well prepared for physical activity as they can be certainly helps, you know. I think for me, it's more about awareness and not prevention from that sense, but actually making sure that that you actually manage it correctly. You know, and of you know, making sure that the initial stages are managed, the ongoing management is right, and they don't return to play until they're ready to return to play. You know, obviously, there's a lot of you know we mentioned about World Rugby looking at a lot of the laws and trying to prevent you know tackles that might end up with head contact. So that's one area they're looking at. I mean, to give you another example, you know, soccer, they made it a red card offence when a defender jumped up with their elbow up. That used to be a high incidence of concussion related to that. So when they made that a red card offence in football, the numbers of concussions actually dropped. You know, so we're looking at the laws of the game and the laws of different sports. You know, the rules in sports. You know, to look at prevention.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. People get maybe a bit isolationist in their approach to preventing injury and go, oh, you know, if we get, you know, we improve our neck strength, that'll reduce concussion. It's like, well, not if you're still putting your head on the wrong side in a tackle. That hasn't changed anything. You're still in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, there's a bit more to it. And I remember having a discussion with a coach about this. You know, he was an S&C coach for a team and saying, the coaches kind of approached him and said, you know, we need to reduce the amount of concussions. And when they got into it, they realized actually, were they better off spending more time on their neck strength protocol, or were they better off doing more contact training with the team to help them with their decision making around tackling? And they decided actually it was the latter, that actually we can hammer the neck strength in the gym, but if they're still getting their head on the wrong side, that's not going to make a difference.
It's multifactorial, you know what I mean, and there's a lot of components to it, and you're absolutely right.
So what about some of the kind of current controversy? So obviously we're seeing some things in the media. Are there any kind of other things that are kind of hot topics at the moment?
Well, obviously, there's the, you know, we mentioned it all. I mean, there's a litigation going on this now from a number of the rugby unions in the UK. The hot topic this now, I think, is the whole neurodegenerative conditions. You know, there's been a number of studies, the field study, which Dr. Willie Stewart, who's at in Glasgow, University of Glasgow, he's been quite involved in a lot of this. There is this condition called CTE. I read recently that this is actually just a diagnosis you can make, you know, on pathology. But actually, I saw something just last week about possible scanning, special scans that can pick that up, you know, in players. Now that's at an early stage, I think. There's also been some research done into a saliva test for a certain protein in the body that could possibly be give you a pitch side assessment tool for concussion, but a lot of these things are still at pretty early stages. But it has become a very, very hot topic this now, and as you know, and there are a lot of people that are doing a lot of involved with the media that are raising it as an issue. You know, and you know we've had, you know, you're probably aware there's been a number of football players from the England team who have recently, you know, like maybe passed away, and it's been sort of dementia or Alzheimer's, that sort of thing. But the field study is probably quite an important study that was undertaken. It's worthwhile, you know, just having a look through some of the results from that, certainly. Mm-hmm.
So if we were trying to give, I mean, it can be quite a big topic, kind of, you know, the deeper you go into this, it doesn't end in terms of you could go to an infinite amount of depth. So for the average kind of parent or coach, you know, if we were to give a 2-minute summary, what would be your real take homes?
You still there?
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got off the screen here.
Fine.
Right. So for me, really, the take-home message for me is that it's a traumatic brain injury. We've got to approach it that it's a serious injury. The important thing is that, you know, to know the guidelines. So if in doubt, sit them out. Know how concussion presents, and know how it should be managed. But at the same time, you know, also accepting that you know, most concussions thankfully do get better with the correct management, and you know, not to be worried. You know, we don't want children or players to be worried about playing sport, but know that there's a lot of benefits for playing sport. But the important thing for me is the education side of it, to make sure that those involved with grassroots, etc., are aware of the guidelines.
Right. So resource-wise, you've obviously mentioned the Sport Scotland guidelines. If in doubt, sit them out. Is there anything else that you would recommend people become aware of?
There's a new website up and running, and some stuff on Twitter as well called Concuss Ed, which I think is run by the University of Edinburgh. And I've had, you know, it's certainly worthwhile having a look at that. There was a good video on YouTube interviewing former players, Dr. James Robson, and it's about an eight minute video, and it's actually quite a useful thing to have a wee look at. So Concuss Ed, but there's quite a lot of stuff out there, but I think you need to make sure that it's on proper websites, etc. But certainly, I mean, for me, really knowing the Sport Scotland concussion guidelines is probably the most important. And you know, when we have our first aid courses, we always give everyone a copy of that and make sure that they have access to that.
Fantastic. Well, where obviously you yourself are spreading good information online as well. So where can people track you down on Twitter if they want to stay up to date with some of your latest things?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. So I'm mainly on Twitter. As far as social media goes, I'm mainly on Twitter. So it's Jeff Cullen Zero, I think, at Jeff Cullen Zero, I think, on Twitter. If you're posting this on Twitter, I'll just, you know, tag myself on it, and so they can get they can find me on that. That's my main, Twitter's my main, the main one for that I use for kind of medical stuff and sports stuff, certainly.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Jeff. It's obviously a really important topic, and it's good to have someone in the know to be able to kind of summarize what's out there and point people in the right place. So thanks a lot for your time.
No worries. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for inviting me on. Hope it's useful, certainly.
If you enjoyed this episode, there's a number of simple things you can do to help support the podcast. First, hit subscribe on your chosen podcast player so you're kept up to date with the latest episode releases. Second, you can leave us a review to help us reach more coaches and parents like yourself. Third, you can send this episode on to a coach or friend to help spread the word. And then fourth, you can find us on social media, on Facebook using Athletic Evolution, and on Instagram and Twitter using the handle @AthleticEvoUK. I'm gonna tell you no matter.